You are not the president or the vice president's lawyer.
He won a case, a big case.
Your loyalty is not to me.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many.
It's to the law.
Well, I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly.
The Constitution.
He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney.
People of this nation to guarantee justice.
Which makes me perhaps the most innocent man anywhere in the history of the United States.
This is Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about the legal problems of presidents and their associates. Because all presidents have legal problems, but some have more legal problems than others. My co-host is Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor, and he writes the Popat Report newsletter on Substack. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh. So
I want to start this week with one of Donald Trump's legal problems that has become one of Joe Biden's legal problems. Listeners will recall that E. Jean Carroll has accused Donald Trump of raping her in the 1990s. While he was president, Trump denied her allegation in particularly crude and demeaning terms, and then Carroll sued him for defamation, saying that he defamed her by falsely accusing her of lying. The Department of Justice under Trump then acted to remove the lawsuit against Trump to federal court and to try to stand in on his behalf as the defendant in the case. The Justice Department can, and in some cases is obligated to do this, pursuant to laws called the Federal Tort Claims Act and the Westfall Act. Now, E. Jean Carroll opposed that effort. It was an effort that would have essentially ended her lawsuit because the federal government cannot be sued for defamation. A key legal question about whether DOJ would end up standing in for Trump was, when Trump declared that Carroll was, quote, not his type and that her allegations were false, was he speaking in his official capacity as president? Under Trump, the Department of Justice said yes, that when presidents make statements to voters about their own reputations, they're acting in an official capacity, even if the reputational matter is not itself about an official act. A necessary part of a president's job is to argue to the public that he should be trusted. A federal judge rejected that argument, and then the Trump DOJ appealed, and then Biden took office. And then the question was, what would DOJ do under new management? Would it drop this appeal, or would it continue to argue that the federal government should be stepping in to defend this case on Trump's behalf? Well, now the DOJ under Joe Biden and Merrick Garland has chosen. In a brief that goes out of its way to condemn Trump's words in a number of ways, the Department of Justice nonetheless makes essentially the same arguments that it had under the prior management. That Trump was acting in his official capacity when he spoke, that the Federal Tort Claims Act and the Westfall Act apply, and that the federal government should be allowed to step in here as the defendant. Ken, does this decision surprise you?
No. It shocks and appalls a lot of people, but to me, it reflects very straightforward Department of Justice institutional thinking. The Department of Justice is under Republicans, under Democrats, conservatives, liberals, always going to be the Department of Justice. It's always going to have its eye out for certain institutional values. And among those is protecting the employees of the federal government. And that's what it's doing here. So, Josh, remember that our baseline is that the United States and its employees have sovereign immunity. You can't sue them for things except to the extent the federal government waives that immunity. And the Federal Tort Claims Act is one of the ways it does that. It says, okay, fine, you can sue us for this select group of things. The Westfall Act is an add-on to that that says basically when you do that, when you sue a federal employee, the Department of Justice is going to step in. And here, the big dispute, the thing that has everyone outraged is that Trump's behavior seems so grotesque. I mean, first of all, it relates to a rape that many people have very little difficulty believing he did. And second of all, the terms on which he denied it were so gross and so Trumpish that it offended a great many people. But the Department of Justice here is thinking, do we really want people to be able to sue the president and other people easily for defamation for things they say off the cuff or deliberately in the course of the office? I mean, Joe Biden is not exactly the most careful speaker ever, and it's not too difficult to imagine him getting sued for defamation for some off-the-cuff comment. That's what Department of Justice is concerned about. They're not so much concerned about how outrageous Trump's behavior was or that this looks gross. They're concerned about not making a precedent where the president is going to be sued for defamation all the time. So what they say is that, well, part of the job of the president is to continue to argue for their qualifications, and part of that is to deny and reject arguments that they are unsuited intellectually or morally or otherwise for the office. And therefore, when the president is talking about how some accusation against them is untrue, they are acting in their capacity as president. That's consistent with a number of cases that have said similar things. It is not at all surprising, and I suspect it's the argument that will prevail. The other thing the Department of Justice is doing here is trying to keep the president and the office of the president from falling into sort of a legal black hole. Because what the what E. Jean Carroll said and the district court said was, well, this Westfall Act that allows the DOJ to step in applies to all federal employees, but not to the president.
That the president is not an employee is essentially what they said.
Exactly, that he's some category in its own. And the Department of Justice's point is that that leaves this weird black hole where you don't know what to do. And does that mean you can never sue the president, or does it mean you can always sue the president? And they're trying to avoid that. So this is a typical Department of Justice institutional concern about not making it easy to sue the government. And that institutional concern leads them to take aggressive stances in kind of gross cases all the time.
So I want to be clear. You're talking here about institutional concerns about the Department of Justice. You make a sort of policy argument there about what might go wrong if the federal government did not step in these sorts of cases. I would note that, I mean, you say Joe Biden's not careful. People could sue him for defamation. Of course, people can also sue you for defamation even if you haven't defamed anyone. And so one of the reasons I guess the government would be concerned about lawsuits like this is the filing of frivolous lawsuits, even if the president does not give people good reason to file defamation suits. But you are also saying here, I think, that DOJ is right on the law, that the Federal Tort Claims Act and the Westfall Act and sovereign immunity behind that, they mean that the federal government is supposed to step in and defend Trump here. And I think people look at that and it feels like an absurd result, because if this kind of statement is an official statement, then virtually anything the president might say, so long as it related in any way to his own reputation, would be protected by this, and he could speak without consequence, even if he makes statements that are otherwise defamatory and other people could be held legally accountable for. And I think people feel like that's a little bit of an absurd result. I think people sort of feel like that can't possibly be the law. But I think you're saying here that the Department of Justice was right under Trump and that it's right now, and that this is what the federal government is supposed to be doing in this situation.
Josh, I can see how people would disagree with it as a matter of morals or policy, but I do think it's the better reading of the cases that are out there now, the cases in which other federal officials have been sued for defamation and what the courts have said about that in that type of situation, that when they are talking about their qualifications and refuting accusations that go to whether or not they're qualified for office, that that is within the scope of their duties. And yes, it's a balance here. On the one hand, you've got this idea that that would make the president free to say all sorts of terrible defamatory things without remedy. But I don't think you can emphasize enough the danger of the frivolous lawsuits. I mean, we are right now, and we've been covering this in this show for 3 years, this danger of really performative lawsuits and the willingness of people now to file bogus suits, particularly including bogus defamation suits, to make political points and to play to their base. And I think that if you let the president be vulnerable to such suits, then it really would be pretty much full-time suing the president for things he said that you can say, well, he didn't have to say, the presidency doesn't require it, and therefore somehow he's not immune.
Joe Biden, when he was running for president, was critical of the Trump DOJ's decision to seek to intervene in this lawsuit. He said it was essentially the then President Trump using the Department of Justice like it was his personal law firm. So now you have not him making this decision. The White House put out a statement saying that they weren't consulted by DOJ about the decision to take this position or the content of the brief they filed taking the position. But it does feel like there's some sort of awkwardness there with Biden having made an explicit statement that the Department of Justice shouldn't be doing this, and now under his management, the Department of Justice is doing that. Is there anything Biden ought to do differently here? Is it just that he shouldn't have made that statement last October? In general, we don't want the White House involving itself day-to-day in decisions the Department of Justice makes, especially ones with high political import. But ultimately, it is the president who is supposed to hire the personnel and set the policies, or hire the personnel who will set the policies that DOJ makes in accordance with his ideology. And so it feels like there's a disconnect there between what Biden has said and what his administration does.
There is a bit of a disconnect, but remember that if we were in the normal world, which we haven't been for a while, the Attorney General is supposed to be independent, the country's lawyer, not the president's lawyer. And the Department of Justice is supposed to be independent from the White House and not making legal choices based just on what the White House directs them to do. So this isn't something that the Department of Justice would normally consult with the White House about on such a legal strategy decision, and it's not surprising that they didn't. And it would not be by any means the first time where, you know, the political elected official in the White House differs from, you know, whether sincerely or as a matter of public relations, from what the Justice Department decides in some particular case. And the remedies, yes, are to get a different attorney general, subject, of course, to the limitations on firing attorneys general. But I would argue that when the Justice Department reaches a conclusion that the White House doesn't necessarily like, that's the system working the way it's supposed to, with an independent Justice Department.
CNN has obtained tape of Rudy Giuliani speaking with Ukrainian officials back in 2019, pressuring them to announce investigations into Joe Biden's dealings with Ukraine when he was vice president, and also into whether Ukraine interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential election against Donald Trump. I have a little piece of that tape to play.
And what we need from the president is to say, I'm going to put an honest prosecutor in charge. He's going to investigate and dig up the evidence that presently exists, and is there any other evidence about involvement of the 2016 election? And then the Biden thing has to be run out. I don't know if it's true or not. I mean, I see him bragging about it on television. And to me, as a lawyer, it sounds like a bribe. Somebody in Ukraine has got to take that seriously.
So we knew the broad strokes of this, that Rudy Giuliani had been acting as Donald Trump's proxy, trying to pressure the Ukrainian president to make these announcements, and that President Trump had been withholding congressionally appropriated foreign aid to Ukraine, trying to obtain these announcements that he thought would help him in domestic U.S. politics. Does this tape have any legal relevance? I mean, the thing we think Rudy Giuliani is being investigated for is whether he violated the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which is to say whether he lobbied the United States government on behalf of Ukrainian interests without registering with the U.S. government. This is him lobbying the Ukrainian government. Does that matter at all for Rudy Giuliani's legal issues?
It probably does not for the current federal criminal investigation of him, other than placing him squarely into this ongoing dialogue between the United States and Ukraine, and the question being, you know, whether he was always playing both sides during that and whether he disclosed that the way he should. Josh, you asked whether this is legally significant, and I would say no, not in the sense of breaking any new legal ground. This is pretty much what everyone always assumed was happening and posited was happening. It's just stronger, more direct evidence of it, that there was a fairly explicit quid pro quo. You know, Ukraine, you announce these things to torpedo Joe Biden, and we will restore these things that you want. So this is just proof that it did indeed happen the way people were accusing Giuliani and Trump of doing it. The question is still, is it a crime? Is it a crime basically to can you bribe a foreign official with an official act of the United States? Is that a crime or not? And was the intent here genuine, that the U.S. just wanted a genuine investigation, or was it purely not really a matter of foreign policy, but a private benefit in the context of the election?
Back in the U.S., we mentioned last week that federal judge Paul Etkin was going to appoint a special master to review the files that had been seized from Rudy Giuliani's home and office, and to sort out what in there is privileged and what isn't. And we now know who that special master will be. It's going to be retired federal judge Barbara Jones, who was also the special master who did this with the Michael Cohen files. So Ken, is this a sweet gig? Do you get paid a lot to be a special master? Why would Barbara Jones want to do this twice?
Well, it is very prestigious. And it sort of establishes you as a go-to person. It often winds up being very lucrative indirectly in that you, who are the special master in these two important cases, are much sought after to be special master in other private cases, to be an arbitrator and mediator, which are very lucrative. Special masters in these types of cases do get paid. They tend on average to get paid substantially less, but still a lot. So if speculating her normal hourly rate is going to be like $1,000, for this work, her hourly rate might be $500. Not as much as she can make, but still nothing to sneeze at.
1,000 sounds low, right? Probably higher than that.
Yeah, well, I don't know. You might be right. Maybe 1,200, 1,400. Who knows these days?
One thing that's interesting to me is Barbara Jones is a partner at the law firm Bracewell LLP, which used to be called Bracewell and Giuliani LLP. Giuliani was a partner there. His name was actually on the door. I guess this isn't a conflict of interest. The prosecutors have agreed to Barbara Jones being the special master here. That just it seems like an odd circumstance that you have the special master here works at the same firm where the subject of this search used to be a name partner.
Not necessarily, Josh. It's not that surprising given how incestuous high-ranking legal firms tend to be. You know, they've all got all these former judges and former U.S. attorneys, and they're all, you know, they all went to law school together. They're all connected by a relatively small group of elite law schools and common experiences. So it's not at all unusual that there's these sort of connections. It's not a legal conflict, and I don't think the two of them overlapped at the firm at any point. So I doubt it's anything that would concern the government. And the government saw how this special master performed in the Michael Cohen case and were clearly very satisfied. So I think that they're not worried about that.
Just as Barbara Jones and the federal prosecutors overseeing the cases related to Giuliani are buried in a sea of documents, so presumably is Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance, who's overseeing the state-level investigation into the Trump Organization and its financial practices. And we have a listener question about how they're doing that investigation.
Hi, this is Pete in California. So how in the hell does Manhattan DA Cy Vance and his team go through literally millions of pages of documents? Do they scan them and control F Trump and criming? Seriously, though. How does any legal practice sift through all the documents of that volume? Love the show.
So, Josh, they use a variety of different techniques. First of all, by the time they're here, where they are, they have a good idea of what people they want to find out about and what time periods they want to find out about. So they're able to zero in and say, okay, let's look at emails between these people during these date ranges, maybe referring to these terms. And that's going to narrow it down very substantially. They tend to have, even if the attorneys themselves aren't always highly technically adept, they tend to be supported by sophisticated IT people who know what they're doing in terms of data analysis and searching. And just as I rely very much on my excellent paralegal for this sort of thing, they rely on their paralegals and tech people. So it's not usually a matter of just literally looking at every single page and going through, although that can happen as well, which is a very thankless job for somebody. It's usually data mining in terms of narrowing it down by time periods, people involved, search terms, and a few other factors like that.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about a new lawsuit from the MyPillow guy. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with Attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Before we proceed, I have a correction from last week and an apology. We talked about an improperly redacted document that was filed in Lev Parnas's criminal case. That document inadvertently disclosed information about what the government had seized in searches related to the Rudy Giuliani search. Now, I mistakenly suggested that the party that had made the redaction error was the government, but this was actually a defense filing, and so the mistake belongs to Lev Parnas's attorneys. So I want to apologize to federal prosecutors for suggesting they don't understand how to use Adobe Acrobat. My apologies. But Ken, one thing that's interesting to me about this is while it was the defense doing the redacting here, the improper disclosures would mostly seem to harm the interests of the prosecution. So what happens if you do that? If you make a mistake in the way that you file in a court case and you reveal information in a way that hurts the other party?
It depends on how bad the error is. what kind of harm it causes and whether or not the judge thinks that you were negligent or reckless, basically. So if it's something that you do that shows that you really weren't making any effort to comply, or if you do it multiple times or anything like that, then you might be looking at some sort of sanctions. If it's a genuine mistake, particularly it might be someone in a support staff or something like that, it's unlikely to have very dramatic consequences.
Mike Lindell, founder of MyPillow, is suing Dominion and Smartmatic, the voting machine companies that he and associates have accused of stealing the 2020 election from Donald Trump. He's suing them for a variety of torts, including defamation. He says that Dominion and Smartmatic defamed him by calling him a liar for saying that they stole the election. Now, Ken, this filing for Lindell is very long. It has section headings like shut up or else. It argues at length that the election really was stolen with charts and graphs. What does a court do when it receives a document like this?
It rubs its forehead in a tired sort of way and sighs deeply. Actually, courts don't do anything when they get a lawsuit. They wait for the defendants to do something about it. So in general, the judge is just going to wait around until the defendants here file a motion to dismiss this very aggressively ridiculous lawsuit, and then will rule on that motion to dismiss. But judges have enough on their plate, particularly federal judges, without affirmatively reaching out and smacking down the dumb, frivolous lawsuits that come into them before anyone else does anything about it.
Mike Lindell, of course, is also a defamation lawsuit defendant. What does filing this lawsuit do for his legal interests in the lawsuit he's defending? I mean, I can think of a couple of things. One is, you know, if Dominion is going to accuse him of knowingly lying or speaking with reckless disregard for the truth, it might help his interests to try to demonstrate that he really, really, truly believes this insane shit. So that he can't, you know, that could help him avoid actual malice. On the other hand, if he wants to argue the sort of stuff Sidney Powell has, where it's like, you know, my statements weren't really meant to be taken as factual and true, restating them in a lawsuit would seem to undermine that kind of claim. So what is, you know, how does this affect your interests as a defamation defendant if you file something like this?
Well, it's picking a strategy, Josh, and you're exactly right. By suing himself in his personal capacity and claiming that all these things are true, he is pretty much making a judicial admission that closes him off from any argument that he didn't really mean it or it was mere opinion. And it's going to be very difficult for him to maintain the argument in other cases that nothing he said could reasonably be taken as a provable statement of fact when he's just said he meant it as a provable statement of fact and that these companies are deterring him from making provable statements of fact. So it really does kind of lock him into one defense, and that defense being that he sincerely believes these things and therefore it can't be reckless disregard for the truth.
California Congressman Eric Swalwell has sued a number of figures who he accuses of helping to foment the January 6th Capitol riot, which personally harmed him as a member of Congress. One of the people he's sued is his fellow member of Congress, Mo Brooks of Alabama. But he's had some trouble serving court papers on defendant Mo Brooks. The U.S. Marshals wouldn't take on the obligation of serving Brooks because of concerns about separation of powers if you have a judicial branch employee try to serve a congressman. And Swalwell said in a court filing that they were having trouble finding Brooks. They needed to hire a private investigator in order to do so. Ultimately, Swalwell's team succeeded in serving papers on Brooks's wife at Brooks's home. Apparently, you can do that. You can serve another adult at the house where somebody lives. And Mo Brooks is very angry. He said they illegally entered his property, that he's going to seek an arrest warrant. He also says, you know, I was at the Capitol for votes. Couldn't they have just served me at the Capitol building? And so, Ken, I guess, tell me about those two things. One is there anything improper about going to somebody's house to serve papers? And the other is, why couldn't Eric Swalwell just walk up to Mo Brooks on the House floor and be like, here, you're served?
Well, for the second question, generally, a party to a lawsuit can't achieve service. It has to be someone else who's not a party to the lawsuit who does it. So that's why Swalwell couldn't do that. You can serve people on the floor of the House, although that's something that sometimes Congress gets persnickety about. And yes, this is a not unusual problem. Some people just love to evade service and make it difficult and expensive to get them into the lawsuit. Judges tend to absolutely hate it. It's a way to get the judge prejudiced against you from the start of the case, but it is something that people do out of spite, or sometimes, as I suspect is the case here, just to to play to the base and to posture. It's very rare for a process server to get charged with anything like trespass for just simply walking up and handing it, and that's what happened here. You can see on the video that the congressman's wife pulls into her garage. The little car swoops up. The guy jumps out, runs into the garage, and then comes running out again with her pursuing him. That's a very typical scenario. Could it technically be a trespass that he stepped into the garage? Yes, but I would be stunned if any criminal authority did anything with that, because they deal with this stuff all the time. And the cops hate it when people evade service, because it just causes them problems.
The point of service requirements is to make sure that people know that they're being sued and have an ability to respond to the lawsuit, right? So isn't this sort of an absurd circumstance where, like, if you're avoiding service, you know that you're being sued? Why isn't there a way for the court to basically establish, Mo Brooks knows he's being sued, we don't need to go through this ridiculous process of having someone try to chase down his wife and hand papers to her?
Well, there are some ways, but they're difficult. The law is very much designed to make it be a little bit of trouble to achieve service. You can eventually, if you have enough trouble, ask the judge for permission to serve by publication, basically to put something in the paper saying, hey, we're suing you. And now and then, you can get a judge to basically accept, based on a variety of factors, that some form of service that was a little marginal is going to work if there's evidence that the person actually knows they're being sued. But I agree with you, Josh. I've always thought that there should be a way that you can just go in and say, here's unequivocal evidence that this person knows they're being sued, and therefore service is achieved.
There's much more we could talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also send a question at kcrw.com/ATPL. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay and recorded and mixed by John Meek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more of All the President's Lawyers.